Israeli settlers storm Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied Al-Quds amid simmering tensions following the Friday assault on the holy place. President Zelensky of Ukraine says he will scrap negotiations with Moscow if Russia kills Ukrainian troops defending the besieged city of Mariupol. Anti-racism protests continue in the U.S. city of Grand Rapids following the fatal shooting of an unarmed black man by a white police officer. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. The situation is highly explosive in the occupied Al-Quds, where just hours ago, Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound again. The Palestinian Red Crescent says at least 17 people have been injured. Also earlier, Israeli settlers stormed the compound. Resistant movement Hamas has reacted to the violations, describing Al-Aqsa as its red line. It's warned that aggression against the Muslims' third holiest site would backfire on the Israeli regime and settlers. In an attack on the Flashpoint Mosque that happened 2 days ago, Israeli forces injured more than 150 Palestinians and arrested 400 others. Palestinians regard the escalation as a declaration of war. They're calling for international intervention to prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Many countries and organizations have condemned the raid, saying that Tel Aviv must be held to account. Now, from Edinburgh, I'm joined by Mick Napier, who is with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Good to have you with us, Mick. So, what's going on, and what can be done about this? Mere condemning the issue is not the solution to the problem.
Contrary to what some people think, condemnations are very frequent. The EU, even the USA from time to time, when Israel is particularly violent, sometimes issues a condemnation. What never happens, condemnation is followed up by concrete action. We see after 6 weeks or so of terrible war in Ukraine, we see massive sanctions, we see the cancellation of not just economic links, but cultural links. I mean, very extreme measures. But after 70-odd years, we don't see any action of a similar type being taken against Israel, although the violations of international law are perfectly parallel. So the Palestinians have tried everything. They've tried international law. They've won their case at the international court against the Israeli wall, the seizure of land and so on, and the court has enjoined every affiliated government to take action against Israel, to have that wall taken down and for Palestinians to be recompensed. The response has been increased arms sales from the USA, the EU, from Britain as well. So Palestinians know that they are increasingly isolated at the level of governments by the UAE, Saudi Arabia, normalization by Arab regimes with the State of Israel. And this desperation is fueling the resistance, because that takes place at the same time as Israel sees an opportunity. There's two aspects to this. One, they didn't win last Ramadan when there was a massive repression against Palestinians across the whole of Palestine, but the resistance rockets from Gaza unified the people in a way that was quite unprecedented. So also, so Israel needs to try to erase that stain of a lack of victory. But the other thing is the Palestinians are desperate. They are living in a pressure cooker. They have to fight this escalation, which Israel plans very carefully. In Israel plans, we know from certain leaked documents, Israel plans the actual calorie intake allowed to Palestinians at Gaza. Mm-hmm. And they also planned the detail of this escalation. It's been very, very minutely planned by their high command. And they decided that when, during the Great March of Return, their snipers killed hundreds and maimed thousands, and Western governments responded simply by praising Israel, the Israelis think that they have not just a green light, but a complete license from these governments to do what they want. What
right.
is amazing is the Palestinian resistance, and they don't seem to be about to be crushed.
Okay,
and
Mick, you said that
remarkable.
Israelis are acting based on pre-planned whatever they're doing, the action. So what's the aim of the plan?
They don't do things, you know, just spontaneously. The fact that the settlers and the police are acting together as, you know, two arms in the same body isn't new, but the but the brazenness of it is. Now, that plan, obviously we know the long-term plan. It is Palestine without any Palestinians. It is Palestine open to Zionist Jews from around the world who will be persuaded or coerced to go there. So the plan is very clear, and the Israelis have always been clear about it. I mean, they cover it with honey, but the plan is for Palestinians to be persuaded to move. And every major Zionist leader has also been clear that the only way to do this is not by playing soft music, it's by great violence. Because every example of ethnic cleansing in the world, every example of colonization, has only been achieved by naked violence. And that's what Israel is inflicting upon the Palestinians. What, in the absence of a unified Palestinian leadership, we see unity beginning to develop at the grassroots. But you know, the individuals who have struck out at their tormentors, at their at the people punishing them and their families, that's the product of desperation. And it's also the product of a lack of a revolutionary unified leadership that we of the type we saw in Algeria or Vietnam or any other anti-colonial situation. Palestinians are uniquely fragmented because they live inside an Israeli prison, and the separation between Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and also the separation every few kilometers in the West Bank from Palestinians able to meet each other. This fragmentation is a Zionist plan, meticulously planned year after year after year, so that when the escalation in violence and repression and killing takes place, the spike in killing, the network, the matrix of repression and fragmentation of the Palestinians is very extreme. So that's why we've seen individuals lashing out at their tormentors.
Okay, appreciate your comments. Mick Napier with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Edinburgh. Now, people in Afghanistan are denouncing the Israeli regime's attack and desecration of Islam's third holiest site, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Afghans urge the international community to take practical steps to protect the rights of the Palestinians and to stop Israeli brutality against them. Our correspondent reports.
Recent waves of Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied territories have stoked anger among Afghans. In a statement, the foreign ministry under the Taliban government has condemned violent attacks and desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds, as well as similar raids and arrests of Palestinians across the West Bank. In the meantime, Afghan rights advocates and clerics gathered here in Kabul and denounced Israel's ongoing crimes and oppression against the Palestinians.
Cruel Zionist soldiers raided on Al-Aqsa Mosque, killing and injuring many worshippers. It's been saddening to all Muslims, especially we Afghans. It's a shame for international bodies and conventions watching Israeli regime crimes. We condemn any terrorist moves under any name, especially Israeli forces killing our Palestinian brothers and sisters.
Like Muslims elsewhere in the region and beyond, people in Afghanistan express solidarity with the Palestinians. They also denounce repeated Israeli attack and desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is Islam's third holiest site. Afghans urge the international community to take immediate action to stop Israeli crimes and atrocities on the occupied land.
Al-Quds used to be the first Qibla of Muslims. Israel has occupied it. Every year at the end of Ramadan, we celebrate Quds Day, and we will do so this year. I also express my solidarity and sympathy with the Palestinians and Lord Palestinian people for defending Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The world today knows that Israeli forces are oppressing Palestinians and occupying their homes. We stand by Palestinian people and support Al-Aqsa Mosque. I ask the UN and other world bodies to do their moral job and protect the human rights of Palestinians by stopping the Israeli aggression.
On Friday, Israeli forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds, injuring scores of worshippers. The regime has stepped up violence in the holy month of Ramadan. People in Afghanistan have long been calling for an end to Israeli forces' aggression against Palestinians. Afghans also praise Palestinian people for their defense of Al-Aqsa Mosque, saying it belongs to all Muslims. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On day 53 of the Russia-Ukraine war, Russian forces strike major Ukrainian cities, including the capital, Kyiv. Moscow says it's attacked a tank repair factory there. The cities of Lviv, Mykolaiv, and Kharkiv have also been targeted in the past day. Ukrainian air defenses say they have shot down several Russian cruise missiles near the Polish border. In Mariupol, tensions seem to be continuing unabated. Moscow says a majority of the city's urban areas are cleared of Ukrainian forces. Russian troops are pressing ahead with their advances there. Ukrainian President Zelensky has once again warned about the worsening humanitarian crisis in Mariupol. He says that many Ukrainian soldiers and injured people have been blocked in that area. Zelensky says that killing Ukrainian forces in the crisis hit city would put an end to talks with the Kremlin. U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has criticized the government for laying the blame for the worsening humanitarian situation in Yemen at Russia's door. Omar said in a tweet that the crisis in Yemen is not due to Russia's military offensive against Ukraine. Rather, it's because of the Saudi-led coalition's brutal war and blockade that's starving millions of Yemenis and because of the U.S. support for that war. On Friday, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations accused Russia of worsening the precarious food situation in Yemen by the war in Ukraine. The Russian ambassador hit back by saying it's the Western sanctions that are blocking food supplies to such countries as Yemen. The country is a major importer of wheat from Russia, but those imports have been badly hit by Western sanctions on Moscow over Ukraine. The leader of the Church of England has launched a scathing attack against British Prime Minister Johnson for his plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, says that Johnson's plan is against the judgment of God. He says that sending asylum seekers away from where they sought refuge amounts to Britain subcontracting its responsibilities. The government drew massive criticism last week after it said that all male asylum seekers who arrive illegally on boats or in trucks will be sent thousands of miles away to Rwanda. Pressure is now mounting on the government, especially after revelations that children as young as 15 are being classified as adults in their 20s so that they can be deported. Rights groups have called the plan appalling and a show of London's total disregard for the welfare of vulnerable people. The French presidential election has roared back to relevance. Voters are upset over the inflation crisis. Many are unhappy with the austerity policies of President Macron, though others are also skeptical of his contender, Marine Le Pen's promises. Robin Mazahari reports.
The French presidential election was trending as an easy victory for the incumbent, Emmanuel Macron, until the unrest in Ukraine began. Macron's insistence on long-term sanctions for Russia exploded already high inflation. That's resulted in widespread hardship, resentment, and tough assessments of Macron's economic record.
It's clear that Macron has not improved the quality of life for the French. He's not responsible for all the problems he's had to deal with, but it's clear there's a big difference between what he's promised and what he's delivered.
The French election may come down to who do voters feel will protect the average person from the economically explosive effect of long-term sanctions on Russia over the unrest in the Ukraine. It's not a question the mainstream media wants to discuss, but it is top of mind for the average person. Polls show the race is now a dead heat, with a soaring Marine Le Pen of the National Rally taking an opposite tack, promising to oppose Russia energy sanctions, which are wreaking havoc with gas, heating, and food prices. As the challenger, Le Pen doesn't have a record to defend, and she's escaping anger over the economic crisis.
Macron has absolutely not done a good job on protecting our purchasing power. The middle class feels that Macron has contempt for the middle class, and they also feel a great contempt for the neoliberal globalist banker Macron.
Macron's far-right economic policies provoked the unprecedented yellow vest protests in 2018. He only made minor concessions before turning to brutal repression, and the coronavirus crisis only aggravated economic inequalities.
Macron needed to go much further in his efforts to reduce prices. It's unbearable to go to the supermarket these days. Even people who make an honest salary say that they are having trouble.
Abstention may reach record highs because many voters wonder if Le Pen would actually deliver on her populist economic promises. Her party has historically been aligned with neoliberalism as well. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Let's take a look at the U.S. now. Public outrage continues to swell in Grand Rapids over the fatal shooting of an unarmed black man by a white police officer. Demonstrators turning out for a fifth consecutive day. The protests remain peaceful, with demonstrators chanting slogans and waving signs. They've been calling for justice for Patrick Aloya. The 26-year-old Congolese refugee was killed in a routine traffic stop early this month, and that was during a scuffle with an officer over a taser in Grand Rapids, Michigan. The officer has not been charged. The victim's family demands that the authorities dismiss the officer and file criminal charges against him. The Democratic Republic of the Congo has also condemned the assassination of its citizens, calling it a cowardly act. Aloya is the latest in a growing list of racial minorities killed at the hands of police. One such high-profile case involved the killing of George Floyd that ignited widespread protests against racism in the U.S. and across the globe. And with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. In the first part of the Aperture, we witnessed various communities which have walled themselves in so that others may be kept out. In urban France, the middle class has increasingly retreated into gated communities. Likewise, in Rio de Janeiro, the middle class seeks to avoid the slums literally across the road from their gated condominiums. Stay with us for more as we explore the wall in Iraq, which American forces have constructed to cordon off the areas of Baghdad.
Abu Hazem's children go to school in Doura, within the walls that encircle the area. So, who wants the wall torn down? No one wants to keep it. What do you think will happen in the future? In Doura, our neighborhood. Yes, Ali. I want more peace and no more walls and gardens. Sports clubs. Better education. So, less walls and more schools. I want to go to hospital without problems. How about you, Hauser? Take the walls away so I can get to the stadium easily. Tell me, what do you think when you see the walls? We're enclosed. It's like prison. I've tried to reassure them about the future. We talk about it, of their vision, and we all hope things will work out. Life doesn't stand still. It evolves. In the areas closest to the walls, the locals are particularly angry. Look, it's a prison. To go to the market, I need to take a taxi and another one to come back. And the market is only a few steps away, behind the wall. And during school, it's even worse. The kids get all muddy. Okay, I know they want to stop the terrorists, but they could take away two pieces of the wall to make our lives a bit easier. It really affects us. Like from dawn till dusk, all we see is this wall. We all know each other here. We all have different religions, but there are no problems. Yeah, the wall drives me nuts. Look at my legs. I'm sick, and I don't have a car to get there. How am I meant to go to hospital? We're all depressed. Put yourself in our place. If you woke up and had this wall right in front of you every day, what would you do? Tell me. In February 2011, Iraqi demonstrators take part in the Arab Spring. They protest having to live walled up. In the weeks that follow the demonstrations, the government will organize a large-scale communications campaign. The Ministry of Interior takes two busloads of journalists to the areas once held by the insurgents, and now completely walled off. Good morning, sir. Now, would it help you if we remove some parts of the wall? Oh, yes, sir. The wall was very harmful to us, but it also brought you safety. Oh, to begin with, yes, but that's all over now. So what would you like then? Leave the wall or take it away? Take it away, please. Where will we put it? Wherever you like. The next morning, it's back to the same area to see if the work is continuing. The crane has disappeared. Just the residents remain, as angry as ever. They never tell the truth. They promised the wall would be gone in a week. Nothing's changed. They say yes, 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 today for sure. And then they come back 2 years later. They built this wall as a barrier between my neighbors and myself. They should take it down and put it on the border with Saudi Arabia. They should have police patrols, not walls. In our brave new world, the differences between military and civilian security technology are becoming blurred. What the army invents to protect its own bases, gated communities adopt for the benefit of individuals.
So when the arm goes down, the teeth come up automatically. That way, if a vehicle tries to ram through the arm, they're going to shred their tires.
Now you have digital zoom while recording the entire area, so you're not losing any video coverage while tracking a person or an automobile that might be coming onto your property.
And present a card, and then this sends the data stream to an access controller, so you can select when someone can get in and when they can get out.
We can put our software, it can be loaded on a smartphone. So if there's a violation at the north gate coming into the gated community, the guard can get an alert on his smartphone with the video clip.
There's like an integration of military materials and civilian materials in terms of security nowadays.
Correct. For residential use, it's just a lighter duty machine, as opposed for things that are built specifically for military or border operations. They have to be much heavier duty.
Thais's mother wants to buy an apartment in this condominium that is even more luxurious than their own. But it's even further from the center of Rio. Regis lives on the other side of the railings, just a few meters away, but has never stepped foot inside.
Do you have any friends inside?
Very few. Well, actually, none. I don't know anyone. But, you know, I don't want to climb the wall that encircles them. I'm not interested in that. I'm just not curious about what it's like inside. I know the kind of person that lives there. My boss, for example. I've never been to his house, but I've got a pretty good idea what it's like. White shirt, yellow tie. Security is very polite. And they don't miss a thing. It's like a labyrinth, a maze. You go in one side and out the other. At least there is an exit. Regis might have said no, but passing the splendid houses every day, he does dream of winning the lottery. Yeah, of course, I'd buy myself a beautiful place. A manor even, with a football pitch, a pool, barbecue. And what about security? I don't know if I'd have any. Maybe a camera and a pit bull. Compared to the favelas in Rio, the Mirai housing estates are havens of tranquility. Hey, no scooters here. It's no good. There are people who live here. It's not good for the kids. Go on, guys. All they have in common is the absence of the state. When his neighborhood became dangerous for the public services, Zubir spoke to the housing administration about controlling the rowdier elements. The mediator's method is to be firm, but not unpleasant. And there's a place available until midnight for the kids who have nowhere else to go. In the past, it was the community police that did this kind of work. Jean-Pierre Avrin used to be the head of the Toulouse police. He's now left the national force and is working for the municipal police. He'd set up a community policing project in the housing estates of Mirai. The video is barely 10 years old, but is now almost historic, certainly unusual. Relaxed-looking police in shirt sleeves in Mirai. The police should not be cut off from the people. It wouldn't be effective. The police have to be close to the citizens. It's the only way to make it work. I think the community police I knew was well liked by the residents. They used to call the youngsters by their first names. And instead of fining them something straight away, they'd say, "Oh, if you could move your car, please, that would be great." They spoke to the kids, and the kids would shake their hands. Now, if you shake a policeman's hands, you'd be considered an informer. Nicolas Sarkozy puts an end to community policing when he is the Interior Minister in 2003. He summons Avrin and his men before the cameras to let them know he's not pleased by their results. There are many of you where the delinquents are.
Vous n'êtes pas des travailleurs sociaux.
You're not social workers. The principal mission of the police is to investigate, arrest, and fight criminal behavior. When I look at the statistics of 2001, 2002 are bad enough, but 2001, to humiliate police officers live in front of the cameras, I had never seen anything like that before. For those who were present, for the policemen, those who were involved for 4 years, to tell them like that, it was a disgrace, disloyal. In the 3 years after the disbanding of the community police, the incidence of violent crime increased by 48% in Mirai. And the rioting witnessed throughout France in 2005 ravages the neighborhood. If they venture into Mirai these days, the police come in body armor. The area is tough, and not just for the police. The nurses don't come as often, neither do the firemen, and the ambulances have stopped coming altogether. It sort of became abandoned because they were scared about being ambushed by the youngsters, not to mention the police. To them, they are the state. So people no longer support the state. Well, let's say they don't trust the state anymore. In the 7 days spent on the estates, we only spotted one police car, and that was a long way off. After saying we could interview them, the Toulouse police changed their minds. In 3 years, the national police force has been cut by 11,000. You can't claim that security is a priority if you cut thousands of police jobs. There was a sharp increase in the number of cars burned, physical attacks, the absence of police on the ground, especially in the more difficult zones. As soon as authority is absent, especially the police, it's like nature, which can't stand vacuum. It creates a replacement authority, which may differ depending on the area or circumstances. I was summoned before senior police officers, and they said, "So, what's all this about then? Is it a militia?" Everyone's talking about it. They felt threatened by it. It bothered them. calling us a militia. A militia with no weapons. If you want to call us a militia without weapons. Our weapons are words. That's it, really. It's a small aperitif in the open air. Here we are then. We said we wouldn't make too much noise so as not to be a nuisance. After that, we said, well, you better leave. Take your bottles and leave. And don't leave bottles lying around here because they get broken and that could cause a lot of damage. The difference is that if a policeman comes to check us, he might smile, but he's stressed. I don't know if he lives out in the countryside and then comes here, but it's better when people who grew up around here and who know what it's all about and who's who, they sort of understand all of that. We're here to stay with them. Sort it out peacefully, quietly, like. We're getting ready, it seems, to allow private security firms to take over some of the work on public property, say, which is a terrible mistake, because all it will do is aggravate the differences between the haves and the haves-not. A two-speed security, in other words. There'll inevitably be one sort of security for the rich and another for the poor, to put it simply. The Rocinha Favela in Rio. The city's prefect is about to inaugurate a brand new health center in the middle of the favela. The drug traffickers are invisible. The prefect has come without an armed escort. We're going to urbanize all the favelas in the city by 2020. All of them. Rocinha will change. There'll be peace. And listen well, I mean peace. The governor will be responsible. Everyone has a right to live and live in good health. Here's the plaque, so applause now. For President Lula's Brazil, the fight against crime means investing in the public services. The people know it, and so do the thugs. The party's over here. At the same time, we need health and education programs, more daycare, more buildings, and to change the urban policies. All that will transform people's lives. Itamar Silvia has lived his entire life in a favela and was one of the first to benefit from state aid. He's a respected intellectual and a man who is angry. In his view, more than public funds will be needed to tear down the walls which separate the rich and the poor in Brazil. The investment we're seeing today in the favelas is only very recent. It's considered dangerous, a place that needs supervision, otherwise we'll all become criminals. What I say, it's not true. If it was true, there would have been a revolution a long time ago. Yes, unfortunately, because that's what we need to happen. In the evening, there's a big party in Rocinha. A new street has been opened. The government has demolished some hovels and built a sort of avenue whose buildings match the acrobatic and multicolored style of the favelas. Another reason to party. The drug traffickers have hung up their weapons and made way for samba. In the background are the condominios, over which night is falling in complete safety. Tell me, wouldn't you be better off in a condominium? Listen, I've been here 50 years and I'm not budging. It's marvelous up here. But you don't want to be safer? Oh, it's very safe here. Anyone can come here and everyone is welcome. No problems.
Speaking of walls, perhaps we can mention more walls which are undermining regional and world peace. The segregation wall built by the Zionist regime of Israel in the West Bank, Palestine. And the recent wall in Hungary, built to keep out asylum seekers trying to reach Europe. And that's it for this week on Aperture. Until next week and another episode of Aperture, goodbye. Thank you.
a diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Dear listeners of this program Lantern, thank you very much for joining us. The title of today's story in this part is The Mouse and the Weasel. A little hungry mouse found his way one day into a basket of corn. He had to squeeze himself a good deal to get through the narrow opening between the strips of the basket. But the corn was tempting and the mouse was determined to get in. When at last he had succeeded, he gorged himself to bursting. Indeed, he became about three times as big around the middle as he was when he went in. At last, he felt satisfied and dragged himself to the opening to get out again. But the best he could do was to get his head out. So there he sat groaning and moaning, both from the discomfort inside him and his anxiety to escape from the basket. Just then, a weasel came by. He understood the situation quickly. "My friend," he said, "I know what you've been doing. You've been stuffing. That's what you get. You will have to stay there till you feel just like you did when you went in. Good night, and good enough for you." And that was all the sympathy the poor mouse got. Greediness leads to misfortune. And now the continuation of Lantern.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin as-Sain. In this episode, we are going to talk about the reasons of the causes of being greedy in human beings. Since this is one of the places where Satan's temptations become very effective on people, the Holy Quran advises everybody to be mindful of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and getting closer and closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and to find themselves not that much attached to the exuberances of this worldly life. Also, in the Holy Quran, in the verses 2 and 3 in the Surah Al-Humaza, it's indicated that people are instructed not to take pride in having more wealth than other people. Rather, from the Quranic perspective, what counts is piety. It's piety that counts for people's being worthier than others, not wealth. Throughout history, we find that there have been many, many wealthy kings and monarchs. I mean, almost nobody could estimate or calculate their wealth. However, since there were people who recognized nothing but money, or recognized nothing but mere power, we find that they committed many mistakes, they committed many crimes.
the lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
And at the end point, were nothing but being defamed and losing almost everything and leaving this world without having gained anything. It's indicated in the Surah Al-Humazah in the verses 2 and 3, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala directs people's attention to keep away from having a kind of behavior, or kind of attitude in which people may neglect Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, all in anticipation of getting hold of more wealth and more and more wealth. And certainly, this is one of the effects and symptoms of satanic temptations in people. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Surah Taha in verses 120 and 121 indicates it for people that Adam, as the first human being and as the first prophet, first divine prophet, used to live in the paradise. However, it was in effect of satanic temptations that Adam lost his place and his abode in the paradise, and he experienced a fall and came upon the ground. And now we find that in the Holy Quran there is a prohibited tree and the fruit of that prohibited tree. Whether it was a tree in the proper sense of the term or it was, anything else, but represented and symbolized like a tree, like a prohibited tree and its fruit, we find that it was Satan that tempted Adam to approach the prohibited tree and to have its fruit. And because of this, because of doing this, we find that Adam was expelled from the divine paradise. Fruits in general are very tempting. So, they are expected to be, wealthy things or wealthy edibles. So when Satan comes to us and wants to tempt us to do something wrong, Satan represents to us, shows to us the positive sides of any activity or any job. At least around 100 benefits out of that job are shown to us by Satan. But when we commit to that sin and we find ourselves to be the losers, Satan pulls himself aside and says, "I never urged you to do so. It was you who approached doing this." So we find that from the Quranic perspective, we understand that in the Holy Quran, it's indicated that Satan just tempts people, and it's the job of people to resist and to withstand satanic temptations. In the Surah Al-Ma'idah, verses 41 and 42, there is the word akalun. The emphatic mode of expressing akal. Someone who eats, but akalun, it's in plural form, indicates that those people who are very greedy try to devour anything, to eat anything, to devour anything, to receive everything. And this is, of course, a very abominable moral trait, something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala repeatedly indicates in the Holy Quran to keep away from. Thank you.
that was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
In the limelight. In 2020, the largest Pentagon contractor, Lockheed Martin, took in $75 billion from taxpayers and paid its CEO more than $23 million. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Lindsay Kashagarian, journalist. This article is published under the heading, More Than $900 of American People's Tax Dollars Went to Corporate Military Contractors. Here's the story. Most of Americans want their tax dollars to be wisely used, especially around tax time. You've probably heard a lot about corporations not paying taxes. Last year, individuals like most of Americans contributed 6 times more in income tax than corporations did. In 2020, the largest Pentagon contractor, Lockheed Martin, took in $75 billion from taxpayers and paid its CEO more than $23 million. But have you heard about many of American tax dollars then end up in corporate pockets? It's a lot, especially for corporations that contract with the Pentagon. They collect nearly half of all military spending. The average taxpayer contributed about $2,000 to the military last year, according to a breakdown of experts prepared for the Institute of Policy Studies. More than $900 of that went to corporate military contractors. In 2020, the largest Pentagon contractor, Lockheed Martin, took in $75 billion from taxpayers and paid its CEO more than $23 million. Unfortunately, this spending isn't buying Americans a more secure world. Last year, Congress added $25 billion the Pentagon didn't ask for to its already gargantuan budget. Lawmakers even refused to let military leaders retire weapons systems they couldn't use anymore. The extra money favored top military contractors that gave campaign money to a group of lawmakers who refused to comment on it. Then there is simple price gouging. There is the infamous case of TransDigm, a Pentagon contractor that charged the government $4,361 for a metal pin that should have cost $46 and then refused to share cost data. Congress recently asked TransDigm to repay some of its misbegotten profits, but the Pentagon hasn't cut off its business. Somewhere between price gouging and incompetence lies the F-35 jet fighter, an embarrassment the late Senator John McCain, a Pentagon booster, called a scandal and a tragedy. Among the most expensive weapon systems ever, the F-35 has numerous failings. It's spontaneously caught fire at least 3 times. Hardly the outcome you'd expect for a top Pentagon contractor's flagship program. The Pentagon has reduced its request for new F-35 this year by about a third, but Congress may reject that too. Most serious of all, there is the problem of U.S. weapons feeding conflicts in ways the Pentagon didn't foresee, but probably should have. The U.S. left weapons in Iraq that fell into the hands of ISIS, Daesh, including guns and an anti-tank missile. Even weapons Americans sold to so-called allies like Saudi Arabia have ended up going to people affiliated with groups like Al-Qaeda. Military weapons also end up on city streets at home. Over the years, civilian law agencies have received guns, armored vehicles, and even grenade launchers from the military, turning local police into near-military organizations. Records also show that the Pentagon has lost hundreds of weapons which may have been stolen, including grenade launchers and rocket launchers. Some of these weapons have been used in crimes. Compared to the $900 for Pentagon contractors, the average taxpayer contributed only about $27 to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, $171 to K-12 education, and barely $5 to renewable energy. How much more could the U.S. get if they invested even a fraction of what they spent on military contractors for these dire needs? Most Americans support shifting Pentagon funds to pay for domestic needs. Instead of making Americans fork over another $900 to corporate military contractors this year, Congress should put American people's dollars to better use.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.